Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the weekend, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And yes, this is episode 274 of the Colombia Calling podcast. And well, it's been a phenomenal week, really, when we talk about Colombia, the week that the New York Times took on the Colombian establishment by reporting the news. It's Nicholas Casey's very telling article about the increase or the proposal to increase kills by the army in order to up the kill count. And of course, Nicholas Casey has left Colombia due to what he perceives as threats against his person. Of course, the thinly veiled threat by the outspoken Centro Democrático politician, Maria Fernanda Cabal. You remember that I went up against her in a debate for TRT News. Anyway, some serious knock-on effects from that. And I would say that Twitter and the social ether out there is still awash with comments and fears about what is going on in Colombia at the moment. That's Maria Fernanda Cabal obviously saying that Nicholas Casey is reporting fake news about these new kill orders from the top down in the Colombian armed forces. So very worrying that indeed. And we as journalists here are concerned about the situation in Colombia. So of course, spare a thought. And if you can campaign on our behalf or anything like that, then this is all positive. The only reason, of course, that this came to light is because it was an international piece. Had it been reported in the local press, it probably would have been, you know, completely buried and then forgotten. So we are, of course, grateful to Nicholas Casey and glad that he's safely out of Colombia at the moment. Very, very troubling times. And of course, with that in mind, I'm going to pass you over to Adrian Alsima, who has some things to say, and of course, the news to report from Medellin for Colombia Reports on the Colombia Calling podcast, and of course, independent media, just as Colombia Calling and Colombia Reports, but Colombia Reports mainly. They are on Patreon, and so therefore you can throw some money their way to continue to support indie publishing and indie news sites telling the truth about what's going on in Colombia at the moment. So that's ColumbiaReports.com, and then there's a banner up in the corner where you can say become a patron. Anyway, I'll leave you now in the capable hands of Adrian Alsima, and we'll be back after that segment, the third segment of the show. We're talking about cycling in Bogota, history of the city, and of course a tale that's I would say filled and rippling with nostalgia about Bogota in a time past, with the cyclist, author, and voice-over actor El Mono Núñez. So we've got him on the show. So very, very great show in the pipeline for you. So without further ado, this is Adrian Alsima. I've been Richard McCall. Please don't go away.
My name is Adrian Alsima, and this is the news for Colombia Calling for May 21, 2019. Both Colombia's peace process and the country's government are in their biggest crisis yet after the release and recapture of FARC leader Jesús Santrich. Justice Minister Gloria Borrero, Chief Prosecutor Nestor Humberto Martinez, and his deputy Maria Paulina Riveros resigned after a war crimes tribunal ruled that there was no evidence to determine whether or when Santrich committed a crime. The United States has insisted that the almost blind FARC leader conspired to traffic 10 tons of cocaine, but has refused to provide any evidence. In a shock reaction, prosecution officials recaptured Santrich as he left prison on Friday. 12 hours later, the FARC leader was in intensive care after allegedly being poisoned. Former guerrilla chief Timochenko begged demobilized guerrillas on Saturday not to abandon the peace process. According to Colombia's War Crimes Tribunal, the United States Drug Enforcement Administration may have violated international law by allowing an allegedly rogue agent collect evidence against Santrich. The court's ruling implied that DEA agent Brian Witte could face criminal charges for possibly having used illegal investigation methods in his attempts to nab the FARC leader. The U.S. Embassy did not respond to the latest of a flurry of scandals that have embarrassed the diplomatic mission over the past year. Colombia's defense minister announced a criminal investigation into the country's army chief after the controversial military commander ordered his subordinates to double their combat kills and captures. Multiple army officials told the New York Times that a pattern of suspicious killings and cover-ups has begun to emerge this year after Major General Nicasio Martinez demanded a dramatic increase in results. The opposition has called for the resignation of the army chief, who is already linked to the murders of 23 civilians, including a 13-year-old girl who was presented as a guerrilla killed in combat. Defense Minister Guillermo Botero is already awaiting a motion of inconfidence over his alleged attempts to cover up the murder of a demobilized FARC member. At least 100 priests are facing criminal investigations for the sexual abuse of children in Colombia, according to newspaper El Tiempo. Church leader Cardinal Ruben Salazar admitted the ongoing criminal investigations, but said that sexual abuse by priests is not an epidemic. The cardinal vowed to cooperate with the prosecution and end the church's controversial practice of transferring priests accused of sexual abuse. Colombia's acting prosecutor general denied that his office has been spying on the country's constitutional court. Acting Chief Prosecutor Fabio Espitia said that his office investigated itself and found no evidence of illegal wiretapping. The Constitutional Court asked the prosecution and the National Police to investigate if their offices and phones were bugged last month after finding out that confidential conversations had been leaked. The disapproval rating of President Ivan Duque has risen to 60% after a brief drop in February, according to pollster Gallup. Only 32% of Colombians approve of the president and his policies. The president is mainly rejected by the people over his economic policies that have led to an increase in unemployment and poverty and a reduced projection of economic growth. That's the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
This is Colombia Calling, episode number 274. We're here in Bogota, Colombia. I hope you've been enjoying the show so far. Of course, that was Adrian Alsamer giving us the news update for this week. Whatever is going on in Colombia, we know that Adrian and Colombia Reports will be covering it. As I said in the opening segment of this show, we'll be talking to El Mono Núñez. His real name is Germán Núñez, but nobody knows him as Germán, but El Mono. We're talking about his book, but actually, really, we're talking about the evolution of Bogotá, because that's how I saw his book after reading it. The book is called Mi Cicla y Yo, My Bicycle and Me, El Mono Núñez. And I see it as a nostalgia for Bogotá, an evolution for Bogotá. But before I sort of get carried away and wax lyrically about this, Mono, thank you for coming here, and thank you for being on Colombia Calling.
Richard, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure. Now, you brought this book out. It was a couple of years ago now.
That's right.
But really, it's a very special book. It's something you made yourself. But the photographs, and of course, you wrote all the text. The photographs, some are yours, and a lot are from El Tiempo, El Espectador, and other places. But so let's start with the very beginning. You are an avid cyclist. You are, like, let's say, Bogota's forefather of cycling. I mean, much more than our current mayor.
That's what they say, but you have to keep in mind that I'm from the north part of Bogota. Uh-huh. In the south, they have the real heroes, but I don't know the south, and many people that call me the pioneer don't know the south either. That's why they call me the pioneer.
The pioneer, definitely.
Just from the north side.
Okay, perfectly. Well, what I see is my vision of this book, Mi Cicla y Yo, is that it's a nostalgia about a Bogota past, and potentially, you know, there's hope for the future. I think, you know, you are aiming at that. There are elements of that, but I see it as an evolution of the city through the lens, or using the bicycle as a lens for seeing Bogota, because you've got family photographs in here, which are great. I mean, you grew up in Teusaquillo, is that right?
Marli.
In Marli. So, yes. So around the 46, just below the Septima, that kind of area. So a nice area where, I mean, when you grew up there, these were big houses, large families, traditional. I mean, how has it changed now? Let's talk about, do you visit these areas often?
Not Marli so much, because it really turned ugly. On the back of my house, there was a beautiful English house where the Piloto University started. Mm. And that was really the end of my neighborhood. That's why my mother decided to sell the house and we moved to the north part. Right. But three blocks from there, there was the Barrio Palermo.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a beautiful one. And Teusaquillo was also beautiful.
Yes. Well, I think about that, the La Piloto is that huge glass building. That's in basically your backyard.
That's right.
excuse my English here, crapping on your memories. So, I mean, that was your backyard. You played, you and your brothers. How many were you in the family there in this house then?
Four brothers and my parents.
Wow, it's such a good family.
Next to it was my grandfather's house. Mm. So we grew up in an 800 square meters house, actually, because it was two houses. Mm. Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I get this feeling. I'm now listening. You are one of these traditional families from Bogota. You are a part of the community of Marli, but of course now you've moved north. But equally so, you go back to these places. I mean, you cycle around. Part of the book takes place in Teusaquillo and others. And you really know the history of these areas in Bogota. For me, again, when I talk about nostalgia, there's a little bit of sadness as well, isn't it? How the city has changed. You know, in all of your years here, and you've come and gone. I mean, you went overseas and so on. But what I like the most in part of this is I guess it's 1981 and you start university.
Yes.
In Los Andes.
That's right.
And you're not cycling, you're hitchhiking to university. and you even give us the address of where you know that cars are going to come past to hit the circumbalar.
That's right.
I mean, in the book, it feels like for you, I'm interpreting it as it was yesterday.
It was indeed, yes. I don't feel that a lot of time has passed. I feel very young. Also, I'm not married. I don't have children. You know, time for me has not had that many changes.
But tell me, so, I mean, 1981... the countryside was in all sorts of turmoil, but here you are hitchhiking to university. The city was still a nice place.
Oh, yes. I mean, we didn't know about many things in the countryside. I was a city person, and I'm still very much a city person.
Because I just think that, you know, when we, those of us who are interested in history and we read what's going on, and of course the breach between rural and urban in Colombia is huge. I said every week. But...
you never encountered any danger, any aggression against your person hitchhiking to university from Mali, I guess, was it? Where were you hitchhiking from?
Yes, Mali.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, I was a special case. My family was a special case because we went to the Anglo-Colombian school, which is very posh, but very few of us lived on the south side of the city. There is an invisible Berlin wall in the 72nd Street. It still is there.
Yeah.
And we were one of the few families that lived on the south part of the 72. And we grew up crossing the Caracas, 13 and Septima, by our own. When I was 7, 8 years old, I was crossing those avenues by myself, and that was not something that you saw in people who lived in other neighborhoods. So we were special in that sense.
So, I mean, the Caracas, the 13, they were still known for being a little bit dodgy, even back then.
Oh, yes.
Definitely. Yes. Why can you sort of explore for me why that was? Why was the Caracas? Why has it always been, let's say, this dividing line between socioeconomic, let's say, communities here?
It didn't used to be like that. Actually, when they built it, it was supposed to be like the Park Avenue of Bogota. Huge houses, beautiful, lots of trees. But the 9th of April changed everything, and the wealthiest families, most of them, moved to the northern part of the city. And the ones who stayed, like my grandparents, they had to see those neighborhoods rotten in time. But they still remained there. They didn't want to go to the northern part of the city. So Caracas, 13, all those neighborhoods, which used to be quite beautiful, they started to go down the hill. And especially where I lived, because of the what we call the garage universities, started to be very present in the city while it was more people were coming in the city. And that changed those neighborhoods. But Teusaquillo remained very well, and La Merced as well.
Very nice,
you know, some of them remained, and some people have been activists since then to preserve those neighborhoods. It hasn't been easy, but they love them. I have friends who still have their parents living there, and they do all they can to preserve those houses.
Well, it's hard, isn't it? I mean, I go down to Teusaquillo and I love it during the daytime. Of course, a lot of the garage universities, as you say, occupying. I mean, who can occupy these houses now? Who can pay, you know, the maintenance of these huge, because they're mansions, the ones, if we think of the Caracas and stuff, and you see Institución Educacional, or something about a health thing or whatever.
Yes.
Who can pay to maintain a house of this size? Because, you know, you need to do the roofs and stuff. Because we went and took a look at some, because I was like, you know, how nice would it be for my son to grow up in a house and have the space? Because my wife and I also work from home, so we would have the space. But you then think, okay, they're selling it for this much money, and then how much would we need to invest in it? And then equally so, you said you went to the posh Anglo-Colombian school. Well, it's no secret to my listeners. My son will be going to the Anglo-Colombian school later this year, I have to admit. And then it will be a long, long journey for him. You know, back in the day, it wouldn't have been so long, not so much traffic. Today, I mean, getting across Bogota is you know, it's something of a Herculean task with the traffic.
Right.
So I find that very interesting, this when you say that Berlin, the invisible Berlin Wall on the 72nd, and you kind of see that as well. From that dates a long way back, you know, that sort of agricultural barrier, the 72nd, and the photos in the past when you can see from the, is it the Porciúncula?
Porciúncula, yes.
You could see that and then fields.
That's right.
We're up above it here. You can't see a field until way out in the Cerro de Suba and beyond. And I think, you know, it's just, it's a different Bogota. And of course, Talking about you going to the Anglo school and coming in from Mali, were you looked down upon for being south of the 72nd? Was it socially unacceptable?
I suppose so, but I was too young to notice that. But I remember going to parties in that school. One of the problems was who is going to bring us back at 2 a.m. Yeah. Because some parents were not willing to go to the south. And it was very close, but it was considered...
It was considered not.
as Oscar Wilde said, the unfashionable side of the city.
It's true. I mean, these things...
But I'm optimistic, you know. We're looking from here one of the most beautiful neighborhoods of Bogota, which is Quinta Camacho. It has had... a comeback,
yeah,
you know, and I'm sure that many people in the near future are going to see the value of places like Soledad, Teusaquillo, actually Chapinero Alto is one of the best neighborhoods today, and people are going to go back to those big houses.
You look at Chapinero and you get, let's say, you get a gay community, and they're always sort of the first, and that starts a gentrification process. Then you get the restaurants and design and so on. And you can see, and foreigners have bought because of the location and the great restaurants and bars and so on. And so you see a difference coming up. I would like to think that also the spread, let's say, west, might hit a little bit into the Siete de Agosto, because again, the location, and if we think of Siete de Agosto and then next to it, San Felipe,
which is
now the new arts district.
I was going to talk about San Felipe.
It's got to be that spread that comes in, because you're getting more, meters for your dollar now, for your peso, and of course it's not what it was 5 years ago. Prices continue to increase, of course, like they do, but there's now a very fancy restaurant down just off San Felipe, La Chicheria is there, you know, and of course near to the Siete de Agosto market, there's the Trattoria de la Plaza,
right.
Which, I mean, these are amazing places that have, you know, run this risk of opening up there. They've taken the plunge, but again, we're veering away from your book a little bit, but equally so, it's something that's addressed, I think. It's beneath the surface there as these changes. And when you look on this picture here, and I'm looking at the Parque Nacional, in your book, and it's just this wonderful, must be in the 1950s or something.
Something around.
Everyone's wearing suits, and the women in long dresses, and the children are out playing. The sun's shining, which almost seems unusual sometimes in Bogota. But you just see that everyone enjoyed the city. There was a sense of belonging in these days.
That's right.
Look at La Merced, well kept behind it. You could tell there's a different attitude. Whereas now... although it is changing, the lack of belonging in the city, because everyone coming from beyond. Where are you from? Oh, I'm from Santander. Well, were you born in Santander? No. I was born in Bogota, but my parents are from Santander. So, no, hang on, you're Bogotano. And that's the thing. And I know Peñalosa the mayor has tried to do that with the billboards on the bus stops. You know,
right.
Yo soy chocoano, pero amo Bogotá. It's the kind of thing he's trying to do. And then, I love this next picture. And it says here, gamines nadando en un caño. Of course, gamin has a different significance back then to now. Gamin, we think of, an inhabitant of the street, someone homeless. But this is just like a young man. And they're swimming. Well, there's little kids there too, but they're swimming down the caños, I think, in the Parque Nacional as well.
It is there,
Which you wouldn't consider getting into today. I mean, so the only people who wash in those now are the actual gamines. So,
right.
But this picture is amazing, and everyone standing alongside it, even the young boys, are in suits. You know, they're in suits. And I mean, you don't see that today at all. So you're harking back to a time past. Let's talk about this. This is so fascinating to me. And of course, we come back to the hitchhiking to university,
right.
Which is phenomenal. Because we don't think of it as a long way, Marley to Los Andes, but, you know, it's a significant distance if you don't have transport or if you have to get on the buses and so on. I think of security. I think of these things because we're thinking of the 80s and things changing, and certainly downtown around the Calle 13 had changed, and Santa Inés was already the Bronx down there. So the security was altering. But you mention about the bike thefts. You've had 9 bicycles in 30 years. So you say it's like a 3.33 bikes per few years. It's all right.
It's a good average.
It's a good average. I've been here 12 years and had one bike stolen, but I haven't bought another one. So that's the thing. You do write about the trick when some guys try and sort of befriend you to steal your bicycle. This very same happened to me a couple of years ago, but they didn't rob me. They were like, they made friends and they talked about my dog because I've been out with my dog in the ciclovia, and they came back and they said they lived in this building and they were going to come down. But winning my confidence. Then he was like, oh, you know, let me try your bike. I'd love to see how it rides. And I was like, no. And he went, oh, that makes me feel so bad that a foreigner, you think badly of us. I went, no, I don't think badly of Danos, but I'm not prepared. We've all heard the stories. And he's like, no, because my dog was tied to the handlebar because he runs as fast. And he said, no, don't worry. I mean, take your dog. And I just want to try it around the block. And I was like, no.
I thought that practice had completely disappeared Everyone knew that it was a hoax, but you think it's still on.
Well, it was 4 years ago, and it was just by Lourdes, and he just went, no, I really want to try. And I was like, no, I'm sorry. And then he tried to play the guilt card. And I came back, and I told my wife, and she's like, that's definitely a con. Yeah. And I was like, I hate thinking like this. Yes. I hate the fact that I was immediately suspicious because these guys, they were being nice, you know, a conversation, and it's so sad.
Yes, it really is.
And of course, they tried to put they wanted to put a kangaroo teddy bear into your basket or something.
Yes, they wanted to keep one for free.
Yeah.
I said, well, how nice of them. But it was so well planned. But this was about 15 years ago. Mm. When I didn't know the stories, but nowadays everyone should know that you can't trust them. But about the hitchhiking, that was so usual, not only in Colombia, but you know, everywhere in the world.
It was a different time.
It was a different time, yes.
And of course, so you hitchhiked, and then, but you also mentioned that you hitchhiked, I think, with a friend to Cartagena.
Yes.
That's a long way. That's a very long way to hitchhike.
But we were young and we were kind of hippies and we just wanted to give it a try. And we managed to arrive in Cartagena 3 days later.
Took 3 days. Wow. But no, I mean, that's for hitchhiking, I would say that's fast. especially, what year are we talking about with the hitchhiking?
81.
81 as well. So you were university students.
We were.
That's when you're fearless as well. You know,
that's right.
And the people who picked you up, families, truck drivers?
Everything. He had a theory that if we went down almost to Cali, we would find there truck drivers who went straight to the northern coast.
The Avenida Cali,
Cali, Colombia.
The city?
Yes.
Okay.
We would find trucks that would take us straight to Cartagena. That was his theory.
Okay, so Cali moved the end up.
It proved to be wrong. We went down there, but no truck drivers took us up. And we ended up, you know, by small journeys, which was very interesting because you meet a lot of people. And we went, for example, to Roldanillo, which is a small village where this painter, I forgot his name, but he used to be a famous painter in Colombia. He was born there, and there is a museum, his museum. Omar Rayo is the name of the artist. In Roldanillo, I never thought I would go
Roldanillo.
It's in Valle.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
And he was a famous painter by the time. I was traveling with a friend who was studying architecture, so he knew all the stories. And of course, Cartagena was the city to go and see beautiful houses and everything. That's why we went to Cartagena.
You had never been before?
No, I had been very many times because my father was from Cartagena.
Okay, there we go. Yeah.
But I didn't look at the way he taught me, you know, to look at the architecture.
Yeah.
And he was the guy who really introduced me to architecture. And he used to live, and he still lives, in Del Saquillo.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Very good.
So...
Well, then you're someone who respects and understands the growth of the city and the way the architecture has been formed. And phenomenal. So, I mean, again, I think it's so interesting, these things, again, a different Colombia, and that's very much in your book, but I would say it's a book of two halves. You know, there's the reflections on Colombia, and then there's the changes. But one other thing I want to talk about is you had a geography teacher at the Anglo called Mr. Woodhouse, and you have a picture of him arriving to school on his horse. I mean, this is a very different Colombia.
I don't know how it is today, but the English teachers at the Anglo really wanted to take these jobs because they were natural explorers and they wanted to know as much as they could. And he was a geography teacher in the eighth grade, and his class was so interesting because he only talked about the places he had visited.
Oh, really?
So he talked about China, for example, and he said, I took this road, I took the other. And he really was an explorer, you know. And when he came to Bogota, I think he rented a farmer's house in the mountain that is now an invasion. It's one of those big invasions. And someone must have sold him a horse, and he just took a 10-minute ride from his neighborhood to the school, you know. And that guy, of course, we were very young to have a closer relationship with him. I don't know if that has changed. But imagine, for example, he took us to Choachi.
Wow.
And that was the first time I went there. And he had, his visit to Choachi was that we had to become interviewers of farmers. So we had to prepare some questions. Mm. And I'll never forget that, you know. We had wonderful teachers at that time. And he made us have a conscience about our country and that we could meet all sorts of people from all levels, and that was, I never forgot this teacher, and that's why I did as much as I could to find the photograph, the original one, because it was in the yearbook, but I had to talk with a friend and to find a good copy of the photograph.
I'd love to show up to the Anglo on a horse today. just tether it up to the railings. So I would certainly turn some heads. I think back then, perhaps not. As I said, in the book of two halves, you start talking about the bicycle culture. Even closer to the present date, and you know, there's some criticism of the bike lanes on the pavements. I think you and I, and most actual sort of cycle fans, would criticize them because you're taking, you know, space from the pedestrians. The idea is to take space from the cars. But new bike lanes have come up actually on the roads themselves. We've got to say that this is positive. They've been, you know, blocked off. This is definitely positive. But we talk about the bus lane, again, it's meant to be for bikes as well, along the Septima and other places. And, you know, it worked for about a month while the police were there, and this is under the Petro administration. And you sort of end on this feeling of, you know, why is it so difficult to achieve positive changes in society? These are your words. Do you have any answer for this? Because it is difficult here to change, you know, habits, let's say. And I remember I was in a taxi who was complaining so voraciously about the bus lane when it was started. And I said, listen, every civilized city in the world has a bus lane because you've got to have it for the masses. And you are not a mass system of transport, although you kind of are turning into one. There are so many taxis. And he quietened down, and then he said, you know, you're probably right.
That's right.
But it's to hear it from a foreigner, and that's the unfortunate truth. But what do you feel about this difficulty? Is it a Colombian thing, or is it just, let's say, countries in development that have this issue?
That's an interesting question. I can only talk about Colombia. And there are all sorts of reasons. We are not a united nation. I mean, that is something that is so sad about us. You don't find Colombians only in football, only in a world championship. We become Colombians.
That's,
you know,
that's
the about
tribal,
it.
Tribal feeling of football. Isn't
yes,
it?
For the rest of our culture, we just don't trust each other. But apart from that, Bogota, I'm sure there was a time you've heard that Bogota used to be called the Athens of South America, and I've been curious about it, and I think it's between 19 and 1920. I think that's the time when people talked about the Athens.
For the well-read citizenry fans.
That's right, and people were very cautious with other people, and there must have been really pride in being Colombian. But, as you know, in most underdeveloped countries, the phenomenon has been more or less the same. People want to have more chances to work, and they come from the countryside to one or two big cities. You know, Mexico City is the great example of that. And what used to be a nice little city turned into something that nobody could rule. You know that Le Corbusier came three times to Bogota, and he himself drew some the limits of the city. I mean, the city cannot surpass this, because if it does, it will become unruly. And that's one of the also one of the reasons why our city became like this. And of course, many people coming from other cities that they are proud of, like Medellin, Cartagena, Barranquilla. They are proud of their cities, but when they come to Bogota, this becomes no one's land. And that's why we don't like to obey orders. I think those are two of the reasons why, but I'm sure a sociologist would talk about this for ages.
Yeah, there's a, I think her name is Mayeli Sabogal. I found some documentation where she debunks the myth of the Athens of South America, that it does exist for a short period of time,
right.
But then of course there's a decline.
Yeah.
I can find it, but it's very interesting. It's sort of debunking it as time goes on, because people, and of course the tourist board, will still say, you know, that Bogota is the Athens of South America.
They still know, say.
And you're like, well, I don't know how. Books are so expensive, you know. So that's why. But yeah, I think there's, you know, there are two sides to seeing this, of course.
But I'm optimistic, because we've seen in the last years Colombians traveling abroad. That's something that had never happened, for holidays or to study. And when they come back, they have a different view of the world, and they say, well, why don't we try to make some changes? And I think that's the reason why we have the bicycle today. Not because of the mayor, but because many people like myself, when I discovered Europe and I went there and I saw people riding bicycles and said, well, this is a great idea. And now that's happening.
You were a bike courier in London.
I was.
So, I like this very much. So, and so you got to know the city. That's the way. And you have to learn the streets. Not the streets.
I had to learn some streets, but I was a very bad courier.
Very good. You know, the Englishman, I found his name and the date, the Englishman who became like the secretary of the Colombian Cycle Association. His name was Donald Raskin, and his father had moved here, you know, to do something or other, and then he came and brought bicycles with him and set up his bicycle shop right near to where all the bicycle shops are now on the Calle 13. So it has to be a historic, you know, evolution of this. He came in 1951. I found the date.
Okay. Donald Raskin.
And he was the one who came up with the idea, and I suppose with the Santos family, for the Vuelta de Colombia.
Oh, yeah,
it's so interesting, isn't it? Because the bicycle is now very much tethered to Colombia. And we think about the recent, whichever tour it was I was watching the other day. I think I can't remember his name, but these cyclists are up there in the top three, top four. My son, who's was Anglo-Colombian, you know, he gets on a bicycle and he shouts, Nairo Quintana, an Ironman. You know, this is really cool. And I think this is giving, the bicycle is giving not only Bogota, but Colombia a new image. I mean, Bogota, you know, of course we talk about the mayors and the politicians, the cycling capital of whomever, whatever. Well, it's not really, but it's not a bad thing to say. You know, it's not a negative thing to say. There's a long way to go, but at the same time, it's so positive to see this, you know, more people on the bicycles, more people out there. I just wish that some people, some more, would obey the traffic norms.
Yes, I know what you mean, yeah. And I talk about that in the book a lot.
It's hard.
It's hard, and I think the reason is that we all have a sort of idea that because we all had a bicycle when mm-hmm. we were kids, we know how to ride a bicycle. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely wrong. We have to learn how to ride a bicycle. And that is something that we should learn in school, for example. Mm-hmm. I make a reflection about that in the book. Why do we learn so many things that are meaningless in our lives? And why don't we... I think some schools actually are doing that today. There are some classes about being a civilian, being a good civilian. And we should go in those classes and cross streets. And teachers should learn, teach us how to cross a street, where to cross it, how to ride a bicycle, and a lot of other things that they don't teach us at school. And are the most important things if we want to live in cities.
Be a good neighbor. It's a social cohesion. It makes the fabric of a city. That's a very interesting point. I hadn't thought of that. I think a bicycle code taught in schools would be, you know, it doesn't have to be much, but just people would then later reflect on that and remember it, just as Mr. Woodhouse on his horse.
That's right.
So we're coming to the end of this, and it's been really fascinating to discuss some of these terms and some of these themes. But tell us about the book, Mi Ciclo y Yo. Where can we get it? Where can listeners of the podcast get your book?
Well, it's in about five or six bookshops like Lerner, Tornamesa, Casa Tomada, Arte Letra, some Nacional still have it, and Universidad Javeriana, the tienda.
Yes. And people can get it online as well?
No,
this just is, in physical.
I wanted to write a book that was beautiful,
okay.
And I'm not a virtual reader. I don't like that, so that's why I never did it for the internet. I like to have it in my hands, uh-huh. And that it's something that I have.
Could people contact you to get the book?
No, it's
just in the bookstores.
It's in the bookstores, right. Because my editor had a very, I mean, he had a point there. He said, it's good that there are bookshops, you know.
Yeah.
If you don't send your book to a bookshop, only your circle of friends will know about your book.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's in bookshops, people that you've never heard of and will never hear about will have your book.
Yes.
And that's a very good argument.
I like that argument very much because, you know, I have a document. I'm hoping to put it together as a book. I've been working on it for years, but it keeps being pushed aside. That projects in my life, let's say my son and my thesis and other things, and this renovation project in Montbos, it keeps pushing it to the side. And I ended up looking at so many negative emails from editors or from publishing houses and stuff. I've been like, maybe I'm just going to go online. Maybe I'm going to do this. Maybe. But hearing this one, and I could still self-publish, but make sure it gets into bookstores. I like that argument. It makes me a little bit more positive about the potential for books in the future. That
yes, that's right. And I've heard that the Kindle phenomenon didn't really was as good as people thought. People are going back to books.
I love
and
books.
Of course, bookshops are wonderful places,
yeah.
Right?
I used to spend hours.
So
you know, I'm off to New York shortly for a short holiday. And one of the things I looked up is independent bookstores. And of course, near to where I'm staying is a couple of independent bookstores. So while my wife is off shopping in other places, I'll just spend hours. I'll spend hours looking, you know, for the spines of these books and mm-hmm. you know, the touch, the smell of the bookstore and so on. Well, I'm sorry we don't have any more time, but this has been really fun, this conversation. So, you know, if you don't forget, I've been talking to El Mono Núñez. His book is Mi Sigla y Yo. It's very nice and very, very interesting reflections on the city of Bogota, but also on the evolution of the city and of course, cycling in the city. So thank you so much for your time, and thank you for coming all this way to record this podcast.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. So we've been talking, this is episode 274. We've been talking to El Mono Núñez. Get his book in The Learner, in Tornamesa, in Casa Tomada, and some of the other bookstores, La Javeriana bookstore, and so on. Get his book, you know, support indie publishing and support indie authors, and learn a little bit more about the cycling culture here in Bogota. Some of you had written in to ask about a cycling themed podcast. We listened and we've delivered. So thank you again. I've been Richard McCall for the Columbia Calling podcast, and come back. Be sure to tune in again next week. Thank you.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.